This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. This is recorded, though, so if you call in, nobody will answer you.
Folks,
here you go.
The MGO Blog Roundtable every Thursday, top of the 9 o'clock hour. I do this like transition thing where, you know, I don't start out the show on video. I have to get everything all set up after we get out of the 9 o'clock hour. So here I am and back with the crew. Pleased to see all of you who are joining us on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook Live. And pleased to be joined again by the MGO Blog crew, starting off first with Brian Cook, BC. Good morning.
Morning.
Seth Fisher. Seth, how are you this morning?
Very relaxed.
And Mr. Craig Ross. Craig, how are you?
I'm doing okay, except Brian's accusing me of kicking puppies.
You said you didn't want Jim Valvano NC State teams in the NCAA tournament.
Was a fix.
You deserve that.
All right, so let's start off real quick, because I know you guys don't want to spend too much time talking Michigan football assistant coaching hiring.
What else are we gonna talk about now, though?
I'm happy to talk about
you. Are the hardest guy to figure out, Brian.
What? this seems, we got a 2-week shutdown. We gotta talk about something.
This conversation seems to be the bane of your MGO Blog Roundtable existence.
Whatever. I had a revelation. I am a different person. Proceed.
Well, oh, wow. This is a Donald Hall poem. The side of this hill swung open. It was Woolworth's. We followed this vision to Boston.
You know, Seth made a comment last week, referencing, I believe it was on Jansen's podcast, wasn't it, Seth, where Jim said, hey, I'm not going to make decisions out of fear of losing my job. And I think that as you've seen him complete his staff, what you said last week, raising that quote, it rung very loudly to me. As a matter of fact, when you said it, it rung loudly because I knew how he was closing his staff out at that time. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, man, that's exactly how he's approaching things. And I wonder if you feel the same way.
Dude, he's just, I think he's doing the best thing he can for Michigan right now. They need players. And you're not going to be able to beat Ohio State if you don't have the kind of players that they have. How do you get players? You go and recruit them. And, you know, if he's around, he gets to coach them up. And if he's not around, then someone else will get to coach him up. But that's still the best thing for Michigan.
You know, I see it as a confluence. Of course he should protect his job. I mean, and of course they should win games. And all, but they're the same thing. You know, if he keeps going on 2-4, 2-4, well, you know, fans aren't going to be happy and then administration isn't going to be happy. So it's the same deal. And to me, it looks like what they've decided is we just got to get a higher quality football player into the program. And that's logical, reasonable, sane, and hopefully it works.
I mean, this reminds me of a Beeline reboot. So he had two reboots in his 11 years at Michigan that really changed what he was doing in the program. First, you know, moving away from the 1-3-1 and going to a lot more ball screens. And then second, the sort of defensive revolution that Donlin and Yaklish led. And I think this was necessary for Michigan. I also kind of like, man, Ed Warner going out the door is a tough pill to swallow, really, because I've been charting Michigan offensive lines since about 1998, and the first year that Warner was here, they had better pass pickups than I've ever seen. I give him a lot of credit for that because, of course, he was walking into a situation where Michigan couldn't pick up anything. So, and Sharon Moore, former OL, seems like a great recruiter, but he's never coached OL before, and you kind of walk into a situation where, man, that's a big gamble because that's half your offense, right? Like, I kind of feel like offensive line coach is like a third coordinator in terms of importance, and that's a gamble. But, we'll see.
Yeah, I think certainly it's a gamble there. It's a gamble when you talk about your defensive coordinator spots being manned by a couple of guys who haven't been coordinators before and bringing in different philosophies or maybe aligned philosophies, but coming from different places and having to take a defensive personnel group and make it fit, even with the holes that it has. But to your point about the offensive line, you know, what I assume he's going to do is, you know, really stock that analyst group in the very same way, because not insignificant was the presence of Ron Prince first and Juan Castillo second. And so it's inconceivable to me that he wouldn't do the same with Sherrone, who, as you said, has not coached the offensive line before. But I think to get to Craig's point where you said it's a confluence, it's really both. I agree with it. I made this point earlier in the week. Who makes moves, you know, for a future that they don't think they're going to be a part of, right?
Bingo.
No one does that unless it's you're like on like a term limit or something like that, where you know you're going to be out. Otherwise, if you can be around, you plan to be around. And so he obviously has to have some faith, more than some faith, a great deal of faith in the coaching ability of these guys. The risk is that it's young and unproven. But the faith, the requisite faith in their ability is there. I think what he's erring on the side of, and I wonder what you guys think of this. I look at these moves and I say, hey, man, you know, all the speculation we maybe came up with during the season about, you know, culture and connection with players and cohesion on the staff, all the speculation that we had about that, these moves to me scream of addressing that piece and recruiting to Seth's point. I absolutely think this is a huge recruiting piece, but it screams to me that he was looking to address those things. I wonder what you guys think.
I mean, it feels like he's taking a home run cut, which is like, if you're in that situation, I feel like that's a good shot to take. The thing that kind of like when Beilein was doing his kind of overhauls, he had some, you know, rope left because he had done very well. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe this works, but maybe it works in year two or year three. And is there a year two and a year three?
Yeah, well, I made that analogy, Brian, and I think it threw some people off because basketball and football are different. But I agree with you about the parallels, that it was year three for Beilein to draw the distinction that you were drawing right now. It was year three when, you know, he basically cleansed the entire deck. You know, Mahoney's out, Jerry Dunn's out, you know, Pilipovic is out, and it's Jeff Meyer, who is the holdover. He moves up to the staff, and you have a couple of guys who haven't coached. I guess Val had coached at Iowa. He had coached at the Power Five level, but you know, really not veteran, not old veteran, you know, really established guys at the Power Five level in Val Jordan and Bakari Alexander. And that mix, somehow, some way, he got the right mix of personalities. And that stands out to me as the best, you know, the most cohesive staff I've seen at Michigan in any sport, guys. I mean, I thought it was a brilliant staff that John Beilein puts together. It's the model that I hold every other coaching staff up to about how it should be done and how it should look.
Well, and those guys had a huge influence on Beilein, Val and Bakari, because Beilein wasn't really a pick and roll guy. And those guys said, man, we got to be playing pick and roll. We need to set more ball screens. And that turned out to be a big success in the Michigan offense. And those two guys get credit for that, I think. I mean, Beilein gets credit too, because he was protean enough to go that direction. On the 1-3-1, that was a different deal, just because they got shredded by Marquette and Alabama in back-to-back games at Madison Square Garden playing the 1-3-1, and that was that. I mean, when it became obvious how to attack that and beat the crap out of it, Beilein couldn't go with it anymore. But I agree. That was, and maybe this is like that. I think the analogy is reasonable. Whether this works into year two is what I was trying to say last week. Well, fans have patience if there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And if you're killing it on the recruiting side, then everybody's willing to say, okay, yeah, but we have all these great young guys. We're really close, you know? So, and to me, that's what's going on. There's a confluence, as there should be, of Michigan's interests and Jim Harbaugh's own interests, and that's fine because it should be that way.
See, I think culture and winning are the same thing. That, like, you know, you have a team that's winning, the culture is going to be great. Everyone's going to be happy. You have a team that's not winning, everyone's going to find excuses. Everyone's going to get mad. And the more you lose, the more people kind of give up. John Bacon and I were talking once about the Ohio State team, Urban Meyer's first Ohio State team, because they hated Urban. Every single person on that team hated Urban. They had like a Jim Tressel, you know, culture there. And everything is supposed to be done the Jim Tressel way. And there were people who were really against Urban who like installed a very professional style regimen for these guys. And some of them really didn't like it. But then they went 12-0, so nobody could complain. And they didn't have a culture problem anymore.
Oh, I have that. If it's not like, the imposition, imposing a new culture in an environment where a good one was already established. To me, I kind of think that it's not an apples for apples kind of thing here. I get your point that if you lose, then it's easy to start pointing some things out. But I think sometimes losing might be revelatory. It might reveal the issue. It might reveal culture as an issue, as one of the causes. Now, again, I'm not in their locker room, but it just seems to me that when you make the moves that he made, he's thinking that, man, we aren't in a place where our guys are responding to us in the way that we need to. Who thinks that, you know, with the talent they had on the field last year, that they played up to the talent that they have, understanding that they have some gaps, but did they maximize things last year? I mean, were they, you know, did it feel like it when adversity hit, it just snowballed? It certainly felt like that to me. Why is that? Why weren't they able to rally?
Because they're young. Young teams can't take adversity, and old teams can because they've been through it before. I mean, I talked to a lot of these old players, and they all say the same damn thing.
Well, the thing that jumps out to me is that if you're looking for the optimistic case, I don't think there is any team in the country that got destroyed worse than Michigan did in terms of injuries and opt-out. So you lose Nico Collins, you lose Ambry Thomas, you lose both of your offensive tackles, you lose Aiden frickin' Hutchinson. I mean, Quiddy Pay is not right for big chunks of the year. You actually do get in. You don't have a safeties coach, which is kind of an injury issue. McGrone goes out. Like, they got absolutely devastated in a way that I think is probably without parallel.
Quarterbacks are both hurt.
Both quarterbacks get hurt. Yeah. So it's like it was a perfect storm of terrible things happening. And, you know, if you get a little bit better luck next year or a lot better luck, which you probably should, things might look a little different.
Yeah, and I'm not sitting here. I've been saying this all week. I'm not selling a dream about how quickly this will all shape up into success on the field. I mean, how could you know for sure? You can't know for sure that guys that haven't done it before are going to be able to do it at a high level right away. I mean, are there going to be some growing pains? You know, are they going to be able to fill some of the gaps that they have with the transfer portal? And there are some significant questions about them and how it's going to piece together on the field, not because of ability, but because of inexperience and the newness of these guys coming together. Where I don't have any questions, guys, I just have zero doubt about this being a much better recruiting staff. I think that he has put together a staff that is any questions you had about their ability to recruit in the state should be immediately gone. I think that their ability to have the stamina to stay in some of these higher profile recruitments where, you know, Michigan they've been dropping offers on guys, you know, all over the place for years now. But defensively, specifically, they drop an offer on some of these big time recruitments. And if that guy didn't just, you know, show great reciprocity off the rip, they're pulling out of that recruitment. And I just don't see that being the case now. I think you're going to have some younger, more energetic guys on the trail, more relationships on the trail, and more stamina for some of these recruitments that maybe they didn't have the stamina to stay in before.
And I think that's fine. And I think that recruiting is – I disagree about the idea that Harbaugh is grabbing recruiting just for the next guy. Because I remember the end of Brady Hoke's career, and I remember, like, Brady Hoke was just, you know – Michigan was falling apart, right? We were a national laughingstock, and people were still arguing to keep hope because, oh my God, what if we lose Jabril Peppers? So if you have like a recruit on your team,
I don't remember that guy. Well, I don't remember the guy passionately.
That's because you abandoned the message board and left it to me at that time, man. I was dealing with those yahoos.
We got to do what we got to do there, Seth.
but yeah, that was a I mean, that's the thing. If you have talented players coming up, people are willing to give the coach more rope because, like, oh, well, you know, Will Johnson's coming here next year. You want to screw that up? So that's I don't think that's the reason that Harbaugh went full recruiting, but I also don't agree that, like, going full recruiting is just a, you know, a future outlook kind of thing. I think it helps his job.
I don't think that is anyone's case here. I think there's going to be a lag time when you prioritize recruiting. It's going to take a couple of years for those guys to actually get into your program and start chipping it. So if you gave up something tactically, you know, I'm not saying that's the case necessarily, but if you gave up something tactically, it's going to be a little bit harder this year because the recruiting effects aren't going to take effect until the next class.
Yeah, like you said, we don't know if they've given how much, if anything, they've given up tactically, but we do know they've given up a lot as far in the form of experience. We do know that. So, yeah. You know, how that affects them immediately here in the short term, that's a big wait and see. I don't think that anyone can reasonably say otherwise.
Well, you know, if you need experience, and we could get Greg Madison back as an analyst. And then he could leave for Michigan State for the trifecta. So then, you know, how sometimes like a guy retires and then he like signs with his original club so he can go into Cooperstown as like an angel or something. That's like the Greg Madison retirement ceremony.
I know I'm on the island here. I know that he is persona non grata with a lot of Michigan people, probably present company included.
Oh,
I get the decision. The dude he padded his retirement by like $1 million.
I understand. I'm serious about this. I would take Greg Madison back as an analyst. He has some good defensive lines.
But you know, I don't. Would I take $1 million to go coach Ohio State? No.
Yeah, but you're crazy.
I know. I wouldn't do it. Would I rather have a finger cut off? Yes. And so.
Wait, what? Would you rather have a finger cut off than $1 million or to work at Ohio State? I'm unclear.
Work at Ohio State. No, okay. Between finger cut off and $1 million, I can figure that one out. I'll take the money. But between coaching at Ohio State and a finger, I'll give up the finger, even if there's $1 million connected.
I ran into Madison. There's a burger restaurant right near my house that pretty much everyone who goes to West Bloomfield, Scout West Bloomfield, will go and get a burger at this place afterwards. And so he and Kerry Coombs went in there right after, I guess, one of these West Bloomfield trips, wearing their black jackets that said Ohio State on them. And the looks that Greg Madison got at like 5 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon or whatever it was. In West Bloomfield. That was like when I understood the move up until that point, but I'm like, man, to be hated by a state that much, like, I'm not sure I would take that.
Literally any Michigan coach has to deal with that in Ohio. Yeah, like, Sherrone Moore can go in Ohio, and they're like, oh, this guy, I know who he is.
Yeah, everyone knows who Maddie is. He retired, and I think, you know, roots, and I think he still has roots here in the state. Surprised if he part of his retirement isn't spent here. So it'll be interesting to see what that's like for him. But again, financially, you know, I never spend out of someone else's pocket. Don't know who or what responsibilities they have, what family members they're caring for. I get it. Yeah. But here's this is an interesting segue because you mentioned Kerry Coombs being at West Bloomfield, Seth. And so as I talk about this recruiting advantage now, that this recruiting improvement that I absolutely believe Harbaugh will experience with this staff, there is a question that continues to come from listeners about Ohio. And wait a minute, I don't see any Ohio ties here. can they recruit Ohio? And the short answer is yes, guys. I mean, and I use Kerry Combs as an example. Kerry Combs didn't know a freaking soul in Southeast Michigan, in Detroit. Ohio State wasn't getting guys out of Detroit when Kerry Combs started going there. And it was strategic. I remember talking to one of the cast coaches about this. And he said, you know, Kerry, when he first started coming to our school, he said that I'm probably not going to get any of your guys. I'm going to recruit them hard. I'm going to recruit them with the hope of getting them. But I know what I'm going to, one thing I know that I'm going to do is make Michigan have to work harder to keep them. And that's going to make them not be as present in Ohio as they've started to become. And, you know, I got to spend more time on the home front before they come down to Ohio and start messing with those guys down there. I remember thinking that's like a chess move. That's not a checkers move right there. You know, to be thinking like that. And it just so happens that he started forming relationships in a way that allowed them to start getting players. Helps when you're winning at the level that they won at too. But yeah, I use that same model if I'm Michigan. I know you don't have an Al Washington on this staff that comes in with connections coming in the door, but you got a bunch of relationship guys that I would feel confident dropping a guy in Columbus, dropping a guy in Cincinnati, dropping a guy in Cleveland and saying, get to work, building relationships. We'll reap the dividends down the line.
Yeah, I just don't know. So one thing that I think has gone under the radar somewhat is the talent level in Ohio has dropped off a ton. They had a total of 6 4-star recruits in this most recent class. So like, yeah, if there's a guy in Ohio that you want and you prioritize and you go after, sure, that's fine. But like, Ohio State is going to get most of the top guys in that state. So you're looking at a pretty restricted number of, you know, high level recruits who you're not fighting from way behind the eight ball on. And like, you know, if it's me, I'm not going to focus too much on Ohio specifically, you know.
Yeah, I guess what is too much? I guess for me, Brady Hoke's approach would be too much. Brady had like 5 coaches in Ohio.
Right.
For your reason, I'm not putting 5 coaches in Ohio. But would I put a couple coaches down there and say, hey, you guys have Ohio as a region. Maybe one of you guys, you know, you have like Northeast and Central Ohio, the other one. Maybe you take Cincinnati and boom, call it, Toledo down to Dayton and Cincinnati. I would do that.
Sure.
I feel like you got to be a factor. If you're Michigan, you got to be a factor in Ohio. You got to make Ohio State work harder for the top guys. And the idea that they're automatically going to get the same could conceivably apply to some of these places that they go in the South. Maybe you can't say, well, Texas is going to definitely get this guy and Texas A&M is going to get that guy. But you could probably be reasonably certain that, hey, you know what, Big 12 or SEC, the conferences are going to get that guy, but they're going to invest in that time down there. So I say do the same thing right here in your neck of the woods on a reasonable level, not the Brady Hoke level, but also not the level that they've been at the last few years where you just don't feel any presence at all for the most part in Ohio.
Yeah, and one thing I think that they should keep doing is they should keep that focus on the Northeast. Because those guys are not properly ranked large slices of the time. You know, they've gotten guys in like Pay, and it looks like Skinner's going to be a hit. You know, McCune was a good player. Mo Hurst was barely a 4-star. Mo frickin' Hurst. So, like, that was the only thing that kind of concerned me about the staff shuffle is I think they've done a lot of good work in New England, and I think that's a place where the Michigan brand – which I'm going to use that as a word now, is like means something, right? Like you go into the schools where it sounds like a law firm and Michigan is like, ooh, I could go to Michigan.
So I guess it gets to the point of how much do you abandon the Northeast? No, I agree with you on that. But can the Northeast be Ohio for Michigan now? And I think the answer to that question is no, too. So how much of your resources do you apply to that region becomes the question for me. And I don't think that you spend as much time. You don't go to zero, but you certainly don't spend as much time as you did, in my opinion, as when Don Brown was the DC.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I lived for 4 years in Boston, and in that area, if you say Michigan, you start talking about Michigan, it's a big deal. And there's respect for the University of Michigan in Massachusetts and in that part of the country. And the upside you have is if you're recruiting a kid from Connecticut or Massachusetts or even parts of New York, even you're recruiting against Boston College.
But why?
And the reason for that is. The reason for that is that the Power Five, a lot of the Power Five schools pay no attention whatsoever to those states.
So, why don't we see Syracuse or Connecticut or Boston College or any teams in that footprint ever do anything of real relevance?
Because they're only in that footprint.
Right.
Because they're only in that footprint, but it doesn't mean that there aren't good kids there, as Michigan has shown. I mean, Quiddy Pay is probably going to be a top 10 pick, and he wasn't recruited by anybody. And so I like the foothold there, where Michigan has traction there. Michigan is a big deal there. And if you go into a kid in Massachusetts and Michigan is recruiting you, you got probably worst case a 50-50 chance on that kid.
And we got a guy on staff now who's kind of from the area.
Yeah. Mike Hart. I would not.
I think it's important to sort of quantify what we're talking about here. I'm not advocating for total abandonment of the Northeast. That is not my suggestion at all. You guys are absolutely right. And Brian, to your point, you got a guy in Mike Hart, who should be able to walk in the door and say, hey, not even say my name, just walk in. And they say, oh, I'm coming. Mike's here, right? That's going to happen. I just, from a focus standpoint, I think it would behoove them to reallocate some of those resources elsewhere. And I think that's what they're going to do. Now, will they be in Ohio? I don't know. That's my preference, my theory. I don't know that they should. I think, based on the way things have gone, Brian, I think they see Ohio like you do. Like, hey, you know, it's just not the same Ohio, so it's not worth it to spend as much time there as maybe they used to. Again, you know, moderation is the key. All right, maybe you don't spend as much time as you used to, but more time than you did.
Yeah, you got to do a little better there. But I think you got to do a lot of better in Pennsylvania, Indiana, maybe Illinois, although Chicago can be tough for various reasons. Like, it's I think it's kind of a broad Midwest thing, and they got to do better in their own backyard. So, you know, Penn State has been mining guys out of Michigan for years now, and kind of stemming that tide would do a lot. I just feel like in terms of ROI, like we spend this much effort, we get this much good play out of the players. I think New England is going to be better than Ohio going forward for a lot of different reasons. Like, it's a broader plane of players. It's not as well scouted. There's no like regional power in New England, but we're not picking. We're talking about relative effort levels. And they do better there.
There's one other thing to say for that. If we're not on to a break right now,
we are on to a break. So hold that. Okay. Hold that thought, and we'll pick it up right there. Mm-hmm. Got to get a little basketball in, right? A little bit.
Hockey too.
John Higgins. Yeah. John Higgins, my boy.
You got to get to that on the other side here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket.
John Higgins sucks, incidentally. I mean, but we've got this guy doing reffing Michigan games as opposed to Ted Valentine is an abomination. Ted Valentine can referee games.
How many times have we even had to bring up the referees this year?
This is really the first time.
So we can't be that bad. And
Pfeiffer called it an A-quality game. That's the really maddening thing. Kelly Pfeiffer called a good game. And Sells sucks, but Sells always sucks, but he was a C. But what Higgins did in that game was just brutal. I mean, that guy, and that's the second time we've had him now since the national championship game, where the Louisville game, where he was in the take or whatever he was doing in that game.
If he was on the take, it didn't work. So at least there's that.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway. I mean,
what was the spread in that game? 8?
It was at Mackey, so I think it was close. It was
7-9, I think, in KenPom.
No, it was like a 4-point game in KenPom.
Yeah, it was below 5.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so I think it was like the DraftKings link I put up. I think it was 4.5. So beating that by 17. Although Stefanovic just
Yeah, that's a huge deal for them. Because they don't have any shooting without Stefanovic.
No. That Ivy kid is just like...
He'll be an old... He's a classical Purdue guy. He's like the big... Yeah, he is. He's like that 6'7 guy they had a point guard from Northwest, from Evanston, who Beeline recruited.
Edwards?
No. This guy was a point guard, left-handed, about 6'7".
Oh, Nojel Eastern?
Nojel Eastern, yes.
Beeline didn't really go after
him. Oh, yeah, Michigan offered Nojel Eastern.
They offered him, but he was not really a fit.
No, he wasn't a fit. He wasn't a fit anywhere, so.
Look, you got a fellow compatriot in your Higgins thing.
Higgins is terrible. He's the worst ref I've ever seen. Well, no, that's not true.
Everybody on the internet stream know that this is what the breaks are always like.
By the way,
next week, names specific people for shaming.
next week, I think you should get your hair cut during the break. I think they should, Mario should come out.
There's so much of it. No.
I mean, Margo should come out and cut your hair during the break. It would this be like really idea. Good radio.
She's an amateur.
You could hear clip, 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 clip. Be good.
Well,
we're back on radio in about 90 seconds, guys.
Gotcha.
Can you make it faster?
Yeah, how fast? How long does it normally take for you to get a haircut, Brian?
Well, I get a haircut about twice a year, so I pay a lot of money and I spend a lot of time doing it because it's like
you pay a lot of money to get a haircut,
like $50, like not like
$50 for a freaking haircut.
How many times do you get your haircut a year? I'm spending less on haircuts than you.
No, I'm not. No, you're not.
I get my haircut once a week and I spend less.
You're probably right. I get my haircut about three times a year and they charge me $15 and then I give them $25. So that's $75, I guess.
I got a mane. You don't have a mane.
You have impressive hair. I'm envious of your hair.
See, that's what my son looks like. That picture, that's what my son looks like after my wife cuts his hair.
Right, yes, very proper. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about the Z that Craig used to have etched in his head. Way ahead of the curve. Hey,
I used to tell those guys the Z was for Zorro. Because that was like a big TV show back.
Yes, then. We
know. My mom
things I had etched in the back of my head. I once had a Tasmanian devil, which was fine.
Notre Dame.
Yeah, that's the bad one. I had a
Sam's got to own that one.
I had a
back on the radio in 10 seconds, guys.
You had a Notre Dame cut into your head?
I had a fighting Irish guy. I did.
Oh my goodness.
The guy was an artist.
That's absurd.
He did a Tasmanian Devil once. He did a San Jose Shark once.
Stand by, guys. Coming back on radio. We can talk more about Sam's hair in 5, 4, 3.
And we are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA online at WTKA.com. As I said before the break, you know, we got to spend a little time on basketball, right? What did you guys – I think I did ask you guys to predict the Michigan-Purdue game. I think you all predicted victories. None of you – if I recall correctly, predicted a blowout. Were you surprised to see Michigan go down there and handle them the way they did, understanding that Stefanovic didn't play?
Yeah, I mean, Stefanovic does make a huge difference for them. If you look at their on-off splits, it's huge, despite the fact that, you know, he's a 15% usage guy, which is usually not a hub of your team, but they just don't have enough shooting without him. I guess I would say I wasn't surprised after I saw the kind of shots that Trevion Williams was getting up. Like, those are prayers. And Williams is extremely good at generating decent looks from basically anywhere in the lane. And when he completely failed to get anything up that was even plausible in the first 10 minutes, I was like, all right, this is going one way.
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly impressed again with the Michigan defense. I don't think Michigan played a great offensive game, but Purdue doubled down in the post, which made it a shooting gallery from three, and Michigan does have four guys that can really shoot it. Actually, five if you count Johns, but he's shooting, I think, 63% for the year from three, but he's only had like eight, I think. But Michigan can shoot the open three, particularly the corner three, and when you're posting you're doubling the big guy, you're just giving those up and praying that Michigan doesn't make those shots. Defense, I continue to be impressed. I noticed on KenPom at least as of a day ago, Michigan was up to number 5 on defense in the country. And that's not where I thought we would be, giving up or having Teske and X graduate, who are both remarkably good defenders. To be sitting at number 5 right now is a testament to the buy-in of the kids and the coaching staff, convincing them that that's the way to go.
Yeah, Franz Wagner defensively, I would definitely put him one of the best defenders in the country this year, because just how much you can do with him. And I mean, you can put him on anybody. He was spending time against the centers in this game, and we've seen that all season. Then you can put him on guards. Like there's nobody who can get around him, and then that just changed the entire look of the defense. And when he's not out there, you don't really feel it, but then like you look at the box score and you're like, geez, they got pretty much all their baskets, you know, the few minutes that Franz was sitting.
Go ahead. Sorry.
You mentioned Johns, and I think Johns did really good work in this game because he got matched up against Zach Edey a lot. And Zach Edey is the size of a dump truck, and he got 2 attempts from the field in this game. And one of them was because, you know, Austin Davis and I think Sean D. Brown kind of got confused on a switch, so he got matched on a wing. So the ability to like keep the ball out of Edie's hands was excellent from Johns. And of course the perimeter guys pressuring the ball helps out with that a lot too. But you know, Michigan had 4 guys play minutes at center in this game. They needed all 4 guys to play minutes in center, and they dominated that matchup.
Yeah. I mean, you felt like Zach Edey was more effective than he was.
Yeah.
I thought he had done more than he did. I looked at the box score. I was like, man, damn, he didn't do anything in this contest for the most part, other than go out there and be big and bother a few shots. But to your point, excellent job that they did. And the thing that I continue to marvel at with this team, how many squads can you look at and say, I made this point to Ira, their best pro prospect, he just is off his game. He has a bad game for him and they blow a team out. Or the senior captain and one of your top offensive threats has a bad game and they blow a team out, or your leading scorer has a bad game and they blow a team out. Michigan has done all those things. We've seen Isaiah Livers struggle and they blow a team out. We've seen Hunter Dickinson struggle. They blow a team out. This was a game where I felt like Franz was basically emotionally hijacked in this game, and they still go out and blow Purdue out. That's the thing that I keep looking at with this team. In addition to how well they play defense, it makes me more bullish on saying they're going to win the Big Ten.
Franz is harder on himself than I think he should be, because like he was missing a couple shots that like, okay, that didn't go in, but you know they were good shots and like they looked like, you know, they just rim out or something like that. Like, and he's getting on himself about those, but like he generated a good shot and it just didn't go in. I mean, I thought he had a good game. It's just, you know, just didn't have luck at the rim.
Yeah, I agree. Franz did. I mean, a lot of people were saying he had a bad game. He did not. He didn't shoot the ball well, but otherwise he had a fine game, a very good basketball game. And I think you're right. You make a really good point, Seth, in that he tends to get down and his body language gets bad and he pouts a bit. That's really the biggest place where he needs to make improvement, because he can do everything on a basketball court. He's going to be – I saw him in the recent mock draft. I think he was number 13 in the first round. And so he's going. He's going to be – He's going to be a first-round pick, and the one place he just needs to stay more up. Now, the interesting thing is for him, he's sort of like John McEnroe when he was on the court in a little different way. McEnroe would go crazy and start yelling over, but most people play worse when they do that, or McEnroe would play better. And sometimes I think maybe there's some of that in Franz, too. That's sort of a self-motivational tactic. I don't know.
His brother was a lot like that as well.
Yeah. You know,
especially early in his career.
Yeah.
His maturation process in his junior year was like, or he had gotten past that.
Yeah.
And that's a great point.
The one thing that I like, you know, Franz is very young. I think he's still a year younger than Dickinson.
Yeah.
If he wants to get to that point where his brother was, and he's just really into being at Michigan basketball, like, then I think he might come back. That's,
you know, I'm laughing because, Brian, you bring that up, and it's a great point because it makes me think of Franz's freshman year. And there was a stretch in there where we didn't really see – I meant Mo.
There
was a stretch in Mo's freshman year where we really didn't see Mo for a while, and then all of a sudden they showed up in the tournament. It's like, where was this? Where was he?
Yes.
You know, what happened? And he had – something happened in the game, and forgive me for not remembering the exact game, but B-Line said something to me. He shot back. He said something. And John sat it for like weeks. For a while, man. So to your point, yeah, there was a maturation process there. That was, you know, his was a bit more stated than what we're seeing from me. This was the first time that I really feel like Franz's emotions got the better of him. And Juwan basically said, okay, go sit down. We got this. We'll handle it. And they got it. They handled it. So no worries for the wear. He'll be back and they'll be fine. I want to get some hockey in here really quickly because so many of you hockey guys are like, I hate playing Notre Dame. This is a terrible opponent to play because it's ugly. It's bad hockey. You got to score the first goal. Brian, they went out and scored the first goal both nights.
They did. And, you know, the shot charts in these games look like a pretty even matchup. But I think Michigan had a significant edge in both zone time and quality of chances. And you're seeing, you know, the historic pace of freshmen at Michigan who are the highly touted first-round types is they kind of start out a little bit slow. And in the second half, they start taking off. And I think you're seeing that from Brisson. You're seeing that from Bordalo. You're seeing that from Kent Johnson. You're seeing that from Owen Power. And this Notre Dame team was coming off a sweep of the number one team in the nation, which is Minnesota. And, you know, I think Michigan had them both nights. And the thing that really stood out is that their power play, which is one of the best in the country, barely got on the ice. Like, I think Notre Dame took one penalty in the Thursday game. And in the Friday game, they took one with like a minute left.
That's correct.
Right.
And that's not possible. It is not possible to play Kent Johnson for 120 minutes and take no meaningful penalties or what? So, like, Mel Pearson had a rant, maybe not a rant. He had a frustration early in the year about the way things are getting called. I feel like that's true. And for Michigan to endure that, overcome it, and get a sweep of a team that's pretty good bodes well. And the pause here is pretty frustrating because I thought they were about ready to take off. Because in the second half of the year, you know, they have that one loss to Michigan State that just looks like a total fluke right now because they won 5 of 6. They've won half of those in dominating fashion, and they've ground out the other two. So they're in a good spot.
What did you think of Portillo real quick? You know, his first start on the road, second start and first start on the road, it looked like he held up pretty well, really well.
He did. He's huge, and so that gives him a lot of leeway. His rebound control is a little bit behind Strauss-Mann's. But he's obviously a quality player. He was a third-round pick, and there's a reason he was a third-round pick. So, you know, he's an excellent backup option. I'm actually, frankly, surprised that he decided to stick out his commitment because he could be starting for a bunch of teams across the country.
Yeah, Portillo was good and has been good in all his appearances, really, this year's. Goals against, I think, are 1.65, 9.41 save percentage. Those are excellent. You know, the Michigan power play is probably the best power play in the country. They're at 28.3%, which is very high. And the only teams that are higher are teams that have played like two games or three games or things like that. And so, and it is mystifying that we're not getting any power plays. And so I don't know what's going on there.
I mean, they had some opportunities to call them in this one.
But you know, they're playing really well, and so Brian's right, the same for basketball. This break is just a killer, and I don't know if they can practice, and I don't know, you know, when you're on a roll, one thing you sure as hell don't want is to say, okay, we're not playing or practicing for the next 2 weeks. And that's, you know, to me, you hear especially sportscasters a lot say, oh, they had to play two games this week, they must be tired. No, they're not tired. They could play five games this week and they wouldn't be tired. It's garbage. I mean, what hurts your game is not playing and not practicing. And
you only need a six man rotation. It's like, come on, man.
Yes.
I mean, he's getting to an important point about like the shutdown that, like, you know, if there's one thing that could derail these teams right now, hockey and basketball, it's sitting in their dorm rooms for the next 2 weeks, not being able to even play with each other.
Yeah.
It's a tough circumstance, but it's seemingly inevitable. I just felt like there was no way they were going to get through this without, you know, some pause, some significant gap in being able to play, and just got to hope that it's 2 weeks. Hope that it's 2 weeks. Hope that, you know, this combined with the students doing the same thing, or that it's being recommended that the students do the same thing, that's enough to get them in a place where they feel like they can get back out there and play. But I got to make mention of Naz Hillman, with you guys getting the 50 spot and now being the single game scoring leader in Michigan basketball history, men's or women's.
Yeah, that was a remarkable thing to watch. You know, Michigan would get it. She was unstoppable, literally unstoppable. Even when she didn't have the ball, she'd get an offensive rebound and put it right back up. It's just someone else hit a three.
There were a lot of opportunities for offensive rebounds in that game, too.
Yeah, I think they were 2 of 20 from 3, and I think Amy Dilk was 2 of 4, so the rest of the team was 0 for 16. You know, and that was the game, essentially. And with their number 2 player out, Leah Brown, that was a killer for Michigan in this game because they were just being allowed to shoot from distance. No one was checking anybody from outside. So
the other Brown, was it Haley?
Haley.
Yeah, she's the one they kind of count on, I think, when something's not going right. Like, and this is the first time I think she just had a plain bad game. And that was, man, like anybody else on that team could have stepped up and helped. Like, because Naz drew them back. They were down by 16 at one point.
Yeah.
And then like she draws them back in and gets them the lead, and then, you know, just couldn't finish it.
Pretty remarkable. Brian, I have a question for you going back to hockey for 1 second. Is the pairwise completely irrelevant this year?
It has to be because the Big Ten only played Arizona State in non-conference, and Arizona State is only playing Big Ten teams. So there's literally no way to compare between conferences this year. So I don't know how the hell they're going to seed and select this tournament. That's probably something that they're going to have to figure out on the fly.
Because I noticed on College Hockey News, Minnesota's number 1 and Michigan is 5. But the pairwise, you know, so I don't know if that means anything at all. But I think it might be about right in terms of where the teams are playing right now.
I think they said that they're going to use a committee this year, that they're really just not going to bother with all their stats.
There's literally nothing you can do except eye test.
I got a question for you. This comes from the crowd. I thought the same thing when I saw this.
Oh.
So, what is that? How is that not a foul, man?
So Brooks is like yelling at Cells, you're supposed to.
We're on the radio too. We're on the radio too, so I got to remember that. The question from the one of the users that's watching the stream said, how is Eddie over the back on Brooks? How is it not a foul? And I was like, and he like smushed him on top of
him. Yes. He treated him like a Goomba and he was Super Mario. That's not legal. You got to call that.
He looked up at the ref like, seriously, ref? You're going to call that a foul? The guy just, he just jumped off the top rope on me. And he let it go. I don't get that one at all.
It was a pro wrestling game in terms
of. So now, now we've got Craig activated and must leave the radio. Let the FCC step in.
Yeah. Hey, well, look, it's fun as always. We'll find no games to talk about. We'll find something next week. And we'll be back with another roundtable as always. Looking forward to it as always. Thanks to all of you who followed us on the video stream. And, of course, all of those that listen to us right here on the airwaves. We'll be back tomorrow here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050, WTK The Ticket, the official voice of University of Michigan Sports, Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station. We'll be right back.
We didn't mention George Brooks at all today. Michigan's got a commitment from a four-star defensive tackle.
Yeah, we can get into that next week. We can talk some